Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
Partner, we'll ask you to come speak to us.
Is that on? Okay, good. Well, I appreciate Andrew's kind words, and it's a delight to be here. My wife and I certainly enjoyed sharing a meal with some of you before the service tonight. And it's a pleasure for me to be at a congregation that has the tie with us through the young people whose lives are our life now for the last 8 years at Freed Hardeman. I love teaching. And I love teaching because I love my students. I regard them as though they were my children. I understand the weight of trust and responsibility. I've been a fiduciary in one sense or another for an awfully long time in my life, I've been an executive and a lawyer, and I have sat on the boards of public companies. And hey, people's money—that's an important trust compared to money. Children are a whole lot more important. I had a friend that was a brilliant trial attorney that I talked into doing some charity work with me for years ago for what was then Agape. And after it was done, he said, "Jim, I love you, but never again." But compared to arguing over a child's future, arguing over a few million dollars was nothing. It was easy. So thank you for your trust, and I hope that we prove worthy of that trust. And thank you, thank this congregation, for the kind provision of the retreat center for the Freed Hardeman Lectureship Committee each year. I've enjoyed that center very much, and we do appreciate your kindness and support of the college. And, of course, I'm delighted to be here at a congregation that I have known by reputation since I was a boy. And I appreciate the long years of labor and faith and love that are represented in this building this evening. My wife and I were talking about why is it that in some places in the country the church is very strong. I've spent most of my life, and my wife also spent most of her life, in places where the church was very weak, where there were fewer people, fewer members of the church in the state of Vermont than are in this congregation. And there are places where the church is very weak numerically and places where the church is very strong numerically. Why did that happen? And the answer is painfully easy, but immensely challenging. It happened because individuals in some places made more of a difference. Because their labor, their faith, their love had a greater impact. And one of the wonderful things about life, and I certainly sense it as a teacher, is that, as Robert Browning said, whatever is at all lasts ever past recall. The faith, the work, the love of people long dead, people who perhaps live now only in the memory of some of those who are present here tonight, still warms us, teaches us, changes us. So I'm grateful to be here and to be part of that community of faith stretching back into the past and hopefully stretching forward into the future. Now, at Freed Hardeman, if you have a lesson, you're supposed to have 3 points. If you don't have 3 points, you're obviously a liberal or something. And tonight, I want to cheat a little bit. And so I'm going to have double 3 points. I'm going to have three preliminary points. Don't panic. I'm going to take the three preliminary points very rapidly, but I want to set context a little bit with three preliminary points, and then I'll have the canonical 3 points about the main lesson. Reaching out for Christ in our culture. Preliminary point number one. This ought not to be as challenging or as intimidating as some people think it is. What's modernism or postmodernism? Some of you may recall an old joke told by preachers. I remember that Foy Wallace would tell it, but I doubt that he invented it. He probably got it from somebody else. What does premillennialism mean? Well, pre means before, and milli means a thousand, and anna means years, and ism means it ain't so. Calling something an ism doesn't validate it. And postmodernism, and before pre-postmodernism, modernism, hey, they've been around as long as human beings have been around. Because they're just words for sin, for human ego, for an unwillingness to decide, wanting to always halt between two opinions. And our world today is not different than the classical world in that regard. I'm a generalist. There are two kinds of experts: experts in one field and liars. And I don't wish to be a liar, and so I'm not going to claim to be an expert in all the things that I teach. I teach like 16 different subjects. And I've had four different professions. My wife has said she'll follow me anywhere but medical school. I need to decide at some point what I'm going to be when I grow up. But to the extent that I have specialized knowledge, it's about the classical world. It's about the Greek language and Hebrew language and Latin language and the literature that's written in those languages. And I can assure you that the classical world was a lot like 2013 United States of America. There are differences, but I put it this way, that the United States resembles more the classical world than it does any period of human history for 18 centuries on either side of the classical civilization at the time of the height of the Roman Empire. An immense middle class, lots of literacy, 70 public libraries in the city of Rome alone. Freedom, you talk about free trade zones, and how about having your entire world as a free trade zone? A great deal of personal liberty. Have you ever thought about how the people in the Bible walk around? And they don't need visas or anything? And personal security? Lydia, a woman, her husband's nowhere in evidence. I don't think she's married. And she goes from city to city. Do you realize how unusual that is? I mean, it wouldn't be unusual in our world, in America. It'd still be unusual in a large part of the globe today, and in most eras in human history, it'd be impossible. So, a world of freedom, a world of wealth that had greater material prosperity than any era of human history until the Industrial Revolution. A world with profound moral problems. You want to talk about homosexual marriage? Hey, Emperor Nero was publicly married to his homosexual partner and publicly consummated that marriage. They had some of our problems. And so, if they could reach that world and turn it upside down, change it, we can do it. Now, preliminary point number two, and I'll try to move a bit faster. What we're trying to reach it with is not a series of conclusions. All right. When I was in New England as a missionary, somebody got the idea, and I wish that I were making this up, but I'm not making it up. And if I unintentionally offend somebody by mentioning this tonight, well, I'm not sure I'm sorry I'm offending you, because maybe you need offending, because somebody got the idea it was a good thing to come up with 100 questions to ask somebody before they baptized them. And you had to make a perfect score. If you answered no, the wrong answer to any of the 100, well, no baptism. Now, that's not an entirely stupid thing. That is, hey, someone who's baptized without a commitment to the thing into which they're being baptized, without a commitment to the new life and a turning away from the old life, all the baptism would just be getting wet. But it's mainly stupid, because what Christianity is not a series of conclusions. The point is, do you tonight, do I, bear a family resemblance to Jesus of Nazareth? Because Christianity consists of being like Christ. It does not consist of agreeing with him. It doesn't even consist of doing what he says under protest. Being a Christian means being like Christ. Not thinking certain thoughts, but thinking in certain ways. Think about the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Blessed are the pure in heart. That isn't describing conclusions. That's describing a way of looking at life. Christianity is ethics. It's not theology. And if you think about the New Testament, the portions of the New Testament that are directed at non-Christians, something that I ask myself constantly, and I think I would encourage you to ask yourself, is if your emphasis about the Christian religion differs dramatically from the emphasis of Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels, all sorts of warning lights ought to go off. Paul's letters. Now, they're about two-thirds theology, broadly construed. And then they always press on, right, to practical admonition, to ethics. Sometimes the transition is made fairly quickly, like in Corinthians, and sometimes the transition, more typically, the transition comes about two-thirds of the way through, like in Romans. But what we're asking people to do is be like Christ, not join the club, not subscribe to our creed, but die to sin, die to everything that they have been, and be born to Christ and accept that new life. And that simplifies evangelism, because you see, you can't do that. You can't talk people into it. You can't manipulate them into it. You can't coerce them into it. Nobody ever coerced somebody into being like Christ. Can't be done. All right, preliminary point number three. You've got to actually teach people and not just reassure them. In our culture, right, part of the problem in our culture is that we're supposed to pretend that everybody's on the same page, even when they're not. Never has heard a discouraging word, not just out on the range, but in churches in particular. I wrote a history book a long time ago. I appreciate it any time. Somebody wrote me an email not too long ago saying how much they enjoyed the book. And boy, does that make an author feel good, especially after 30 years. But it's a history book that concentrates on some churches that died a long time ago. And they took a long time to die. They took about a century to die. And all I noticed in their own histories, Nobody ever says we're dying. Everything's wonderful right up until everything's gone. Right up until the silence. Now I know that some people like to hear preaching and teaching, and I'm not a typical preacher. When I was a young man, I was preaching in Florida, and there was a lady, and she was sweet as she could be. She was the wife of one of the elders, and after I got through, she wanted to encourage me, but she didn't want to lie. And she said, well, it wasn't preaching, but it wasn't bad. I know that part of us wants to hear just confirmation. Just somebody saying something to which we can say without thought, without ambiguity, just amen. Hey, everything's fine. And people in the church are like that, and people outside the church are like that. And we want to, hey, I want you to be happy with me. Nobody likes disapproval. But teaching means changing somebody's mind. See, the problem is if I never say anything to you that you don't already know, whatever else I can claim to be, I cannot logically claim to be a teacher because I haven't taught. I haven't said anything to you that you needed to hear. The world, I think, probably knows it's a mess. We're the richest society, and I understand people have been struggling in the last few years, and some people genuinely struggling, but there's a difference between struggling to keep your four-bedroom house and three cars and struggling to keep your children from starving in the morning. And America's had the first kind of struggle. We don't have the second kind of struggle. And the second kind of struggle is all around us in the world. But we're rich and we're free and we know a lot and we're desperately unhappy. Desperately unhappy. Perhaps because we know so much. Perhaps because we are so rich and free that we can't lie to ourselves anymore. We can't say, around the next corner, I'm going to meet happiness. So you got to teach. You got to give people something that changes them. Now, those are the preliminary points. The main points would be these, and they're biblical principles. The first point that ties to the last point that I made as a preliminary matter is that, hey, evangelism ought to be honest. And by that I mean in a lot of ways, no manipulation. Manipulation doesn't work very well in most circumstances in life. I was talking at dinner night before last with a guy who worked for Enron. And I wish I could be more positive about that conversation because, well, for various reasons. Any plan of campaign toward other people that depends on your being a lot smarter than they are and their being dummies is probably a bad plan. You can't count on being the smartest person in the room or the most dominant personality, and you certainly can't count on it causing anybody ever to become a Christian, a genuine Christian, to become like Christ. And so, hey, be honest. Is the offense of the gospel avoidable? Now, I'd say this, as much as within you lies, be at peace with all men. There's absolutely no reason to go around picking fights over things that don't matter. I feel like there's so much tension in this life, so much inevitable conflict, that it pains me. It aggravates me when people want to fight about something that doesn't matter. But there are things that do matter and they're worth fighting about, and no one, you are not going to hurt your chances of reaching anybody by admitting that. Let me take an example to follow this up. What is an, through the years, again, I've spent most of my life where churches are small and where visitors were a large proportion of the people who were present for sermons. And in that context, I have invited and seen and talked afterwards with hundreds of people who have visited the church. And what do they notice about church if they come from an so-called unchurched background or denominational background? There's singing. Most places it's wonderful. Sometimes it's not. Right? When I was preaching in Vermont, we had three different visitors offer to buy us a piano because our singing was so bad that they felt that the only possible reason we wouldn't have a piano would be poverty. Now, they're right about the poverty, but wrong about the reasons. They notice that there's no organ. You want to have a fight about instrumental music. I personally think that it's worth fighting about in some sense. The servant of the Lord must not strive. And it used to chill my blood. I haven't heard it in a long time, and I'm glad to say that I haven't heard it in a long time, but it used to chill my blood when somebody would say about an old gospel preacher that he was a man of war from his youth up. I would hope not. But Christ needs to be Lord over all things to the church. Head over all things to the church. And those words were not going to have any real meaning if every time you face a practical decision, you ask yourself, well, what do I like? What makes me feel good? Instead of, what would Christ wish me to do? And I think instrumental music is a good test case. Maybe the reason why God would care about instrumental music, maybe the reason why God evidently chose, right? We look at the New Testament. We look at the early history of the church. They didn't use instruments of music. That's a fact. That's not an opinion. That's not an interpretation on my part. That's just the way it is. And speculating on the reasons, maybe God wanted to say, are you going to do things my way? On the most basic level? So I think I'm willing to argue about instrumental music. What I'm not willing to do is argue about the thing that isn't the real question. Why do people come down differently? Now, maybe there's somebody out there who is worried about the meaning of the Greek word, but as somebody who's spent, I've invested thousands of hours in learning Greek, and therefore it pains me a little bit to admit that most of it is wholly unnecessary, that it doesn't provide any additional insight into the meaning of most passages because the English is clear. But maybe there's somebody out there who's worried about the meaning of a Greek word. I haven't met him. I've been a Christian for nearly half a century. I've taught the adult class in churches since before I was an adult. I started preaching because the other men in the little mountain town where I grew up couldn't read or write. I haven't met the person for whom that's the issue with instrumental music. I haven't met the person yet. I've been to Harvard Divinity School. I haven't met anybody at Harvard Divinity School or anywhere between Hillbillies and Harvard Divinity School who claims that the early church used instrumental music. That's not the problem. What's the problem? Well, there are a number of problems, but the fundamental question is, what's worship? Is worship the fulfillment of my emotional needs? Or is it my submission to the God who made me? And even more fundamentally, what's grace? You know, those who believe in salvation by grace alone, by faith alone, that character has absolutely nothing to do with it, and they take it to its logical conclusion. Even if you kill somebody, that has absolutely nothing. God's not going to damn you to hell for any action, because no action on your part can possibly affect your salvation. If people believe that you're not going to go to hell for murder, they are sure going to believe that you're not going to go to hell for an organ. Right? I mean, that's silly. False teaching about instrumental music in the church is grounded in false teaching about grace. That's its historical background and its intellectual background. So, am I willing to argue? You bet. I'm not willing to argue about things that aren't the argument. Get it, what really is the concern of people. And I've made that mistake throughout my life. I use an example with my students about a young man that I knew who said he told his parents that he had a problem with the evidences for the existence of God and the inspiration of Scripture. And I talked to him and accepted his explanation. I knew better than that, but I accepted his fallback falsehood. And in a couple of years, I got a call. He was dying of AIDS. His problem was he was a bisexual. Argue about the things that are real. Don't argue about the things that are not real. So teach honestly, trust the gospel. This business of sowing seed that God designed. Hey, I think I'll trust His judgment about what it is that will change people. Second major point, teach lovingly. Have you thought about the true meaning, the true emotional meaning of what Paul says there in Romans, where he says, if it were possible, I would be willing to be estranged from Christ, if thereby my brethren according to the flesh could be united with Him. I'd give up my soul if it were possible. John Donne, the great English poet who was dean of St. Paul's Cathedral and on whose sermons I wrote my honors thesis in college, every time that he got up and preached, he cried. And I'm sure that probably got old to some people in his congregation. I'm very emotional myself. Yeah, I'd like... one of the retired professors at Friedman said, I cry at AT&T commercials. Sentimentalism is neither a virtue nor a vice. It's a personality trait, but how you show your emotion, that isn't what I'm really talking about here. I'm talking about risking yourself to care about somebody, to really care about them, to be hurt if they're lost. Why does the church not reach out to people as it should? And can we all agree that we don't as a people nationwide? And can we all agree that there have been times in our lives when we were silent when we should have spoken? That we were reticent when we should have reached out. I don't think it's laziness. I think most people, most Christians that I know are good, hardworking people. America's really up on work. I think it's that we're afraid to injure the emotional ties that we have with other people. I think it's afraid that we're afraid to be hurt by their rejection and that sense of failure that we might have. And I think that even more fundamentally, that if we really cared about somebody and they were hurt, they were lost forever, if we let ourselves really care about that, we wonder if we could bear the burden. My wife and I have known one of the most brilliant specialists in American medicine, young man who left his specialty because half his patients, they're mainly little children, die. And people who were less sick didn't see him. And he got to the point where he couldn't bear that burden. I understand that. Every time one of my students fails, and I don't mean make a bad grade, I'm talking about failing. I'm talking about not becoming wiser and stronger, better, not growing up. Every time one of my students fails, it hurts me. And I know the temptation to cut that off. We need to reach out to other people because the stakes are so high. I was interviewed today. I was in the Boston Marathon, and I happened to be away. I'd finished long before the bombs went off, but I'd stopped at a restaurant to get lunch, and so I come out of the restaurant, and the bombs go off 300 yards from me. And I got interviewed this morning for the 20th time by somebody about that. And, you know, they're asking me, well, did it make you, how do you feel about the bomber? The bomber was somebody for whom Christ died. He could have killed me. He did kill others. He killed a child. He faces justice. I hope justice is done. But he was somebody for whom Christ died. I ought to be hurt more by his peril than by mine. And finally, to teach purely or teach by example. Now, this is really tough, and I understand that I'm saying things that can be misconstrued. Many years ago, I was teaching at the University of Tennessee. I was talking to a group of people. I was an elder there at the Laurel Congregation, and in the Christian Student Center, they had me in. And after the talks, a fine young man, he was the son of one of our elders, said, "You're an elitist." And I said, "Great, you were listening. You bet I'm an elitist. Because God has called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. A royal priesthood, a holy nation. That we should show forth his praises. And if we're unwilling to do that, all of us will fall short in various ways, right? Just like people can always make perfect plans but not execute them perfectly. Samuel Johnson very well described much of life as like teaching the art of navigation on land. It's not the same thing as being on the boat. We're going to fall short. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is that if you're unwilling to give your life in a way that matches the words of the Gospels, if you're unwilling to deny yourself and take up your cross daily, a cross, not a hobby horse, take up your cross daily and follow him. If you're unwilling to make yourself better than other people. You know, people accuse us of feeling that we're better than they are. Shouldn't we be? If Christianity doesn't change me to someone who is different than the world, what can it be said to have done for a man, in the words of William Law, writing in 1728? If it doesn't change my attitude toward the world, what did it mean? One of the core ideas in the Restoration leaders, especially in Bartonstone, but also in some of the other Restoration leaders, was that they lived in a time of tremendous religious revival where people were talking a good game of religion. And Bartonstone said, hey, this religion talk has got to mean something. You can argue about what it means, but it's got to mean something, something tangible. What is it that God wants us to do? Who is it that God wishes us to be? We've got to ask that question rather than hide in unexamined emotion and fulfill our own vision of who God ought to be rather than face His vision of who we ought to be. Well, I didn't allocate my time wisely, but I'm through. Thanks.